Remember, we found out that we can solve the Klein-Gordon equation on Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker cosmological spacetimes in the following way. There are three points to remember. This ansatz will succeed, so we can write the quantum field solution as a sum over so-called mode functions multiplied with raising and lowering operators if we take care that the A and A dagger are mathematical objects which obey the usual A and A dagger commutation relations, and we can generate such objects from the commutation relations. Remember, we can build a Hilbert basis of Fock basis vectors. So that's one condition for this ansatz to succeed. The other condition is that those mode functions have to be classical, or better expression is number valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. It's clear that if U and U star are number valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, then this will be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, but a non-commutative one, an operator one, because the A and the A daggers are non-commutative. We found that it's not sufficient, though, to have these obey the canonical commutation relations for A and A daggers, and to have these be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. On top of that, we also needed that these mode functions obey this complicated condition down here, which is like a resolution of the identity. And the reason for that equation here was that we need the canonical commutation relations between the A's and the A daggers to induce or to imply the canonical commutation relations between phi and pi. And that was non-trivial. For that purpose, we needed that the mode functions obey that condition over here. It's a little complicated, but that's because this is the condition in the completely general case of an arbitrary curved space-time. As it turns out, in the case of Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker cosmological models, this condition will become much tamer, much simpler to work with. It will simplify. Second thing to remember is that these A and A dagger operators generate a Hilbert basis. So we start out with a vector that is annihilated by the A operators. So it's one vector annihilated by all of the A operators. And we normalize that vector, it has length one. Then we apply A dagger operators on this starting vector here. And in this way, we obtain a huge set of orthogonal and normalizable basis vectors, and they span our Hilbert space. Now, this beep beep is not good, right? Let me just make sure that this stops. Excuse me, can you stop the beep beep? It's probably the connection to West in that. Okay, thanks. All right. Yes. Yes, it's from Western, I think. They're looking into it. Maybe nobody's picking up over there. Actually, it's an incoming call. Maybe we are not picking up. That's what it is. I see. Okay. So I hope they figured it out over there. Good. All right. So with this A and A dagger operators, we can generate Hilbert space, a whole Hilbert space, on which the A and A daggers are naturally represented as operators that obey the right commutation relations. Now, a subtle point that we came to at the end of the last lecture was that this is not a unique procedure. there is more than one way to succeed with these answers. There's not just one set of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation which obeys that. No, there are plenty of them. There are infinitely many choices for sets of solutions UK such that this condition is obeyed and such that therefore this quantum field obeys all the conditions, which is hermeticity, canonical commutation relations, and the equations of motion. Fortunately, it is the case that any such solution differs from any other such solution by a mere choice of by a mere change of basis only. So that's the third point to remember. If we choose a different set of mode functions, let's call them U tilde now, then we can write the same solution phi hat of x and t in terms of this ansatz, where we have different mode functions and therefore also different A and A dagger operators. So they will be A tildes and A tilde daggers. Sorry, I'm going again. They didn't figure it out. Sorry, I think they are calling us and we are not picking up. Could it be?
Yeah. That one is spare.
But you see, every few seconds it does beep, 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 beep. It's annoying.
It's spam. I'm getting David to come and turn it off.
Okay, thank you. Apparently, it's not Western, it's a spammer. Yes, it's a video conferencing spamming. Yes, yes. If you look at the number, it's a weird number too. Yes, it is. All right, okay, so let's just try to forget about this beeping thing.
There must be a way you can hit reject on that thing.
Yes, and they're working on it. Need a team of experts to hit that button. Okay. Right, so there are many ways to make that ansatz succeed. All of them describe the same quantum field. However, with different mode functions, different A and A dagger operators, but the whole thing is still the same as what we had before. It's still the same quantum field. It's I just represented it slightly. It's written in a slightly different way. And this really shows up as a change of basis because when we now represent our quantum field in this way, and we use our A tilde and A dagger tilde operators to build a Hilbert basis, then this is going to be a different basis in the same Hilbert space. Okay. So we're going to have a 0 tilde vector. I'm not calling it the vacuum just yet, right? But it's going to be some 0 tilde vector. There are A tilde dagger operators acting on it, generating new vectors in that Hilbert space, and the whole Hilbert space is spent by the linear combination of those things. Now, so far, this is all very general. When we apply this to Friedmann, Robertson, Walker spacetimes, then things become simpler. In fact, if you remember, we can make them even simpler by choosing a new field variable. Instead of considering the problem for phi itself, we multiply phi with the prefactor a of eta. Remember, eta is the conformal time variable. X are the comoving distances. So we define a new field chi hat of eta and x, which is the scale factor multiplied with the field phi. This is just number valued, and there's a time dependence in this. But other than that, it's really trivial. So if we can find out what that quantum field is, then trivially, we will know what phi hat is, simply by dividing the chi by A. So then we wrote above what the conditions are that the and this what the strategy is to fulfill those conditions for phi hat. Let us translate that into conditions and the strategy for chi hat. Now, in terms of chi hat, the quantum Klein-Gordon equation looks like this. And you notice there is a second time derivative. It's a prime rather than a dot because it's derivative with respect to conformal time rather than to proper time. And these are spatial derivatives in a co-moving coordinate system. Here we have the second time derivative again of the scale factor in this case. And notice that there is no first time derivative in this. When we wrote down in the last lecture the Klein-Gordon equation expressed in terms of phi, we found that there was a term proportional to phi prime, which is technically looking like a dissipative term, like a friction term. And by this simple change of variable from phi to chi, we were able to recast the equation of motion in this form where there is no friction term. So the advantage is that we know how to handle this type of equation. It's basically a harmonic oscillator type of equation. So we work with the chi, and once we have the solution for it, the solution for phi will pop out trivially. Now, this is a partial differential equation because it has both spatial and temporal derivatives. It turns out that we can simplify the situation just like we could on Minkowski space. We can do a Fourier transform in order to get rid of the spatial derivatives. Then we only need to worry about the dynamics of each mode separately. For each momentum, for each wavelength separately, we can study the dynamics. That makes it easier. So if we remember the observation that under Fourier transform, a derivative with respect to x becomes a multiplication with respect to the independent variable, in this case, a momentum variable. So before we try to solve the Klein-Gordon equation, we will do a Fourier transform. And here is the Fourier transform forward, and here is the Fourier transform backward. So we start with chi hat as a function of conformal time and co-moving coordinates. And then the Fourier transform is the Fourier transform factor. And of course, that means a three-component k contracted with a three-component x integrated over. That gives us chi k of eta. The notation may look a little weird because when we write chi in position space, we have here a time variable and then comma, the position variable, whereas here we have the time variable, and then the Fourier transform of x, the k variable, is written as a subscript. That's just because it's the convention in the community. There is no other good reason for doing it this way. And then there's a reverse Fourier transform, of course, where instead of a minus sign, we have a plus sign. Other than that, it looks just the same. We integrate now over all k values, and we get back the original field. Notice, though, that k is slightly non-trivial. K is the Fourier transform of x, and x is the position in a co-moving coordinate system, in a coordinate system that grows along with the expansion of space-time. Therefore, the meaning of k changes, right? It's a wave vector, all right, but what physical wavelength it means changes over time. Because it's always the Fourier transform of x, whatever x means at that point in time. Remember that in co-moving coordinates, two galaxies that are just freely floating as the universe expands will have the same numerical distance in co-moving coordinates all the time. Their distance does not change. Which means that their wavelength k is not going to change. So if you take now, instead of two galaxies, a wave of a long wavelength, maybe as long as the distance between two galaxies, a wave with long wavelength, and we follow it over time, and we see that as the universe expands, the wavelength gets stretched out. Therefore, the physical wave vector, let's call it p, will diminish. Right? Because the wavelength is getting larger and larger. But not so k, right? Because in the co-moving coordinate system, distances stay numerically the same. So the k is a wave vector that's adjusted to the growth of the universe. We do a similar Fourier transform for the canonically conjugate momentum field to phi. Sorry, not to phi, to chi. Remember from the end of last lecture that there's a subtle difference between the canonically conjugate field to phi and that to chi. This is the canonically conjugate field to chi. Okay, so just the same thing, usual Fourier transform. And now we can rewrite the Klein-Gordon equation, which we had as an equation for phi hat, now as an equation for chi hat. And the Klein-Gordon equation now has second time derivatives and no time derivatives here and no more space derivatives because the spatial derivatives have, through the Fourier transform, become simply a term k squared. So that's the Klein-Gordon equation in momentum space, in co-moving momentum space for the chi field. Notice that this is basically a harmonic oscillator. Because what we have is that for every fixed k, we have a variable chi hat whose second time derivative is proportional to the variable itself. And for an ordinary harmonic oscillator, that proportionality, this proportionality constant is actually a constant in time for a fixed harmonic oscillator. And this constant is the frequency squared for an ordinary harmonic oscillator. So let us introduce a definition. Let's call this thing omega squared. Because in the case where this is not time dependent, this really is just a regular static harmonic oscillator whose frequency is omega. So we can write the Klein-Gordon equation, which is now an ordinary differential equation for each k separately, so it only involves one type of derivative, the time derivative. We can write this now as exactly an ordinary harmonic oscillator, like this, with the slight non-triviality that it's a parametric harmonic oscillator, one with a time-dependent frequency, the kind that we discussed early on in this course when I brought in this little piece of string. I showed you how you can excite it by changing the length of the string. The time-dependent frequency is given by that. It's the square root of this, right? Because the whole thing is omega squared. And we notice that something funny can happen here, which is that this term that I brought to your attention last time already, this term comes in with a different sign than the other ones. So for example, on Minkowski space, same deal. It's Minkowski space. This is a Klein-Gordon equation, exactly like that. We don't even have to change from phi to chi in Minkowski space because the difference between phi and chi is the scale factor. In Minkowski space, the scale factor is 1. Okay, so in Minkowski space, this is the Klein-Gordon equation, and the omega is square root of k squared plus m squared. Okay, where this is the physical momentum squared, not the co-moving one, the physical one in Minkowski space. And of course, A is constant equal to 1 in Minkowski space. But now we see what happens to the equation of waves when the universe is expanding. We see that we can consider waves of a fixed wavelength and follow them in their evolution in time. And by fixed wavelengths, I mean fixed co-moving wavelengths. So you fix a wavelength, for example, now. Let's say you consider a wave that has wavelength, I don't know, a million light years now. And as the universe expands, that wavelength is expanding along with the universe. And while it expands, the wave is oscillating. Okay. What we have mathematically expressed here is that we are following this one wave because we are looking at the dynamics for one k value. But one K value means a particular wavelength followed in time as it is growing, because it's the Fourier transform of the X variable, which is the co-moving coordinate system. So we're looking at the amplitude dynamics of a wave whose wavelength is growing with the expansion. And we're looking at, if we choose different K values, we take waves of different wavelengths, and each of them we just follow as it expands in space, and we look at the dynamics of its amplitude. This is what describes the dynamics of its amplitude. And we notice here that if A double prime is small, if this term is smaller than those two terms, then the square root is the square root of something positive here, and we get, as usual, just a positive frequency. Therefore, for such k, we are dealing with a wave of a particular wavelength determined by k. As the universe expands, it will grow its wavelength, and its amplitude will oscillate with the frequency given by this square root. However, there's something special going to happen when this term becomes equal to that term, and this is zero, or even larger. Right? This one can grow even larger than that. The discriminant here can go negative, omega can go imaginary, and that means this thing goes negative, right? I mean, it's clear. This thing becomes more significant than that, so the whole thing goes negative. And then we have a harmonic oscillator where the second time derivative is not proportional to minus the elongation, but plus the elongation. In this case, the solution to the harmonic oscillator is no longer oscillatory, but instead it's exponential, right? Instead of sine of t, or cosine of t, you then have the hyperbolic sine, or the hyperbolic cosine, and those guys grow exponentially. So we'll have to find out what the physics of this is, when that happens. But one thing we can already take away from those formulas is that it will be k-dependent. Waves k, which have a very small value, where k is very small, so the ones with the long wavelength, right? Small k values, like small momentum, small co-moving momentum, the small k values waves, the ones with longest wavelength, are most vulnerable to this sine flip. Whereas those waves, which are very short wavelength, and therefore large k squared values, are not so vulnerable for this to happen. So we can already see that there's going to be a different behavior for small wavelengths, which are vulnerable to this, small wavelengths, which are not vulnerable to this, they should behave just ordinarily, and large wavelengths, which are vulnerable to this. It turns out that the threshold is the size of the horizon of the expanding space-time. Waves whose wavelengths are larger than the horizon will have this sign dominate. Okay, so as we already said, the frequency omega k may become imaginary, namely if that term dominates, which is to say that either k is very small, or really if A double prime is very large, because of this. So if the universe expands with a large acceleration, then there is a chance for this sign to flip, especially if the mass is zero. If the mass is zero of the particle, of the species of particle, if the Klein-Gordon field doesn't have a mass, then that term is absent. And then if the universe has some positive acceleration, this sign is guaranteed to flip for sufficiently small k, which is to say for sufficiently large wavelengths. Give you a bit of an exercise here. Check that the chi field, as we defined it above, obeys the hermeticity conditions, and so does the canonically conjugate of it. Check that the canonical commutation relations hold. Notice that this is not a misprint. Here we have a plus sign, and here we have a minus sign. There is a difference between this and that on the left-hand side. I hope you can spot where it is. So this is the canonical commutation relation between chi and its momentum field. And that is the canonical commutation relation between chi and its momentum field. However, this has a dagger over there. Okay, this has a dagger. And if you remember the hermeticity condition for the Fourier transform of real valued functions is this one, or that one, right? So if you take if chi of x is a real valued function, its quantization is a self-adjoint operator valued function. So if chi is something real valued and you Fourier transform it, now you have it as a variable of k, then when you take the Hermitian conjugate, or for functions of number valued functions, the complex conjugate, then you get the same thing as before, but with a minus over there. Right? Just to say that real valued functions, the real valuedness of a function has a consequence for its Fourier transform. And that is the consequence for the Fourier transform. So now if you plug that into here, you get from here to there. Okay? So it's just a subtle thing. You probably noticed that during this course, I sometimes point out little subtle things like that. They might look like small details, but if you actually go through calculations and want to do some research in this, this can cost you a week or so. If you don't know why there is a plus sign here or a minus sign, and you might think you did a mistake or something, you know, it's good to keep that stuff in mind. Okay, so remember we said early on that we can solve the problem of quantum field theory of the Klein-Gordon field on a curved space-time with this ansatz here. Now we do that ansatz for the chi field rather than the phi field, pretty much the same thing. We write the chi field as a mode function multiplied with a plus a mode function times a dagger. And the structure here is such that we have the k's over here and the minus k over there. This will guarantee the hermeticity condition. Right? If we take the dagger of that, we must get the same thing with a minus sign over here. That's guaranteed, because if we take the dagger of all of this, the Hermitian conjugate of it, then these guys become those. And that becomes this. So up to a minus k, it becomes the same thing. Little exercise for you. What is the relationship between the mode functions v and the mode functions u that we had earlier? Mode functions u arose in this ansatz for phi, and the mode functions v arise here in this ansatz for chi. Very easy to find out. So here's a proposition, namely that this ansatz succeeds for the equations of motion, hermeticity condition, and commutation relations for chi. It solves the hermeticity condition, as I already explained, by construction. The equations of motion will be obeyed by chi if the v obey the equations of motion. It's easy, because this thing is constant. So although it's operator valued, although it's really to be thought of as a matrix, the A and the A dagger, they don't disturb the property of v of being a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation for chi. And what is the Klein-Gordon equation for the mode functions? Well, remember that chi has to obey the Klein-Gordon equation. Here it is. Chi has to obey the Klein-Gordon equation. Keep in mind how it looks like. And then we make this ansatz, and we say that chi is going to obey that Klein-Gordon equation if the v star and the v obey it. Easy. So they have to obey that. The v have to obey the Klein-Gordon equation the same way that chi does, only that v is just a regular number valued function. But other than that, it's the same equation of motion to solve. Now the canonical commutation relations also have to be obeyed. Now, remember from the very beginning of today's lecture, I reviewed what the condition is on those mode functions such that the A and A dagger commutation relations translate into the phi and pi commutation relations. And it was a complicated equation to do with the resolution of the identity. Now, in the case of Friedmann, Robertson, Walker spacetimes, this simplifies dramatically. Where we used to have a Dirac delta on the right-hand side of that equation, after Fourier transform, it basically becomes a 1. The Fourier transform of the Dirac delta in space is a 1. And so actually, that equation becomes this one. After Fourier transform for Robertson, Friedmann, Robertson, Walker spacetimes, that's the equation that we have to fulfill. In reality, the 2i really arises here as a 1 over 2i prefactor of the whole thing, and there's just the 1 on the right-hand side. Anyway, I put the 2i on the right-hand side. So the problem, in order to solve the Klein-Gordon equation on an expanding spacetime, has reduced to the following. Find mode functions vk of eta such that they obey the Klein-Gordon equation, and such that they obey this equation here. This is to make sure that the chi will obey the Klein-Gordon equation. And this is to make sure that the A and A dagger commutation relations, which we enforce by construction, translate into the proper phi, into the proper chi and pi commutation relations, which then translate into the proper phi and pi commutation relations, as we showed earlier. Those of you who are familiar with the theory of ordinary differential equations may recognize that the left-hand side here is also known as the Wronskian of an ordinary differential equation. And we know on general grounds that that's a conserved quantity, the left-hand side. So I leave it to you as a exercise to prove that this proposition is right, and in particular that this is the condition that needs to be fulfilled. It's not difficult, just a few lines. Now, also, as an exercise, assume that vk of eta is a solution of the equations of motion, of the Klein-Gordon equation, such that at a particular point in time, this equation holds. Then how can we convince ourselves that it will hold at a later time as well? Please do that little calculation. When I last taught this course, we had a final exam, and that question was on the final exam. No, we're not going to have a final, but if we had one, this would be a good candidate. It's not so easy and not so difficult to show. You just take the time derivative of the whole equation there, and you basically show that the left-hand side is not changing over time. So you get a second time derivative over here, and you get two terms, right? You get a time derivative of this, leaving that alone, or you leave that alone and have a time derivative of that, here the other way around. And then you use the equation of motion, which involves the second time derivative, and you can show that it's conserved in time. Which is to say that the conservation of the canonical commutation relations, that the holding of the canonical commutation relation, which is what this enforces, is conserved in time automatically. Okay, so to summarize, in order to obtain a solution to the Klein-Gordon problem in cosmology, what we do is we pick an arbitrary k, so we pick an arbitrary wave vector, we choose a particular wave, a particular wavelength in a particular direction, right? Arbitrary, we really want to cover all of them, but we just pick a variable k that stands for one of them. And then for that mode, we find a solution, a mode function vk of eta, a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, a number-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, which is really technically just the solution to a harmonic oscillator, and in fact a classical harmonic oscillator, not even quantum, because the vk are mode functions. They're not operator-valued. They're only used to produce the operator-valued field, right? So this is just some number-valued function of time, a solution to a classical harmonic oscillator, where the non-triviality is that the harmonic oscillator has a time-dependent frequency. And the frequency may go imaginary. It's not quite sufficient to make sure that the V, the mode function for each k, obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. We also have to make sure that this so-called Wronskian condition is obeyed in order to make sure that the canonical commutation relations hold. And that condition was, we had it here, this one. And there's one aspect of that that I'd like to point out already, because it will come up again soon. The Klein-Gordon equation is linear in V, right? If you have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, if a mode function that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, then if you take 5 times that mode function, it still obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. If you have 2 solutions and you take the sum of them, still obey, the sum also obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. Not so here. If V obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, then the Wronskian condition, 5 times of it will not. Right? That's nonlinear. So this is a restricting the solution space. And in particular, it provides something like a normalization of the solution. If you take an arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then you can make it, most of the time, also obey that equation here, but only if you rescale it. There's a particular prefactor that you can choose, and not other prefactors. By the way, can you see already whether all solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation can be made to also solve that Wronskian condition if you just multiply it with a proper prefactor? The answer is no. There are some solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation which cannot be used for our purposes, because they cannot obey that condition. Therefore, those solutions cannot be used to create the quantum field. And how is that? Well, this is a harmonic oscillator equation, and in particular, there will be solutions to this with the V being a real valued function of time. Right? We hold K fixed, of course. We look at one mode. So V as a function of time may well be real. If you plug that into a differential equation solver, it will find a real solution. In fact, if you look at the general solution, it will be a complex valued solution, and the real part is completely independent of the imaginary part, because the whole thing is linear. Right? You can always take one solution plus I times another solution, you have a complex solution, easy. But if you take a real valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, it cannot obey that. Cannot obey that condition here, because this condition can also be viewed as the statement that the imaginary part of this has to be I. Okay? But if V is real, then V is V star. Doesn't have an imaginary part, so can't obey. Okay, so what we notice here is that we actually need a mode function that is a complex valued solution to the harmonic oscillator, and then normalize it properly, then we can use it for our purposes. And we can use it in the ansatz for the quantum field. Okay, so once we've done that, chose a proper mode function and so on, then we can write our quantum field in terms of the mode functions and the A and A dagger operators. And we can build up a Hilbert basis of our Hilbert space on which the field acts in the usual way, just the Fock basis. However, remember that there are many different ways to do this. There are many different solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Not all of them can be renormalized so that they also obey the Wronskian condition and therefore can be used for representing the quantum field. But many of them can, infinitely many of them. So let's say we choose for every mode k, every wave vector k, we choose some solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, complex valued of course, which also obeys the Wronskian condition. And then we shelf that and we pick another solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, complex valued, where all of those solutions obey the Wronskian condition as well. So now we have a set of mode functions Vk and a set of mode functions Vk star, and both can be used to represent our quantum field. Associated with the V are the A operators, and associated with the V tilde are the V tilde operators. Therefore, we obtain in the first case a representation of our quantum field chi hat in terms of that basis of the Hilbert space. And in the other case, we obtain a representation where this is the basis that we construct when we use the tilted operator. And we will often find it convenient to choose the basis appropriately to the situation. In principle, of course, as you know from ordinary first quantization quantum mechanics, it doesn't really matter in which basis you calculate something, because the expectation values, because anything that is measurable is some sort of expectation value. And expectation values are always basis independent. Same is true in the quantum theory of a field. So in principle, we could just, you know, choose one set of mode functions here. It comes with A and A daggers. And that provides us with a basis for the Hilbert space. And we work with that forever. Possible, but not convenient. Okay? So we will make use of other choices as well. And why and how? But remember, if we choose one set of mode functions, then the associated A and A dagger operators will be used to generate a basis of the Hilbert space of the theory. And one vector stands out. It's the vector that's annihilated by all the A operators. That's the vector 0. If we chose another set of mode functions, let's say the tilted ones, V tilde ones, then they have associated A tilde operators, and we can build another basis of the Hilbert space of the theory. And one particular vector stands out, it's the 0 tilde vector. And there are infinitely many choices. Whichever choice we choose, we make for the mode functions, we get a different vector 0 there. Now, let's say that very early on in the universe, we have reason to believe that it started, it was in the vacuum state. Then it will turn out to be convenient to choose mode functions such that the associated vector 0 happens to be the vacuum state at that early time. So if we are studying the physics of the early time, of early times, where the system was in the vacuum state, it is usually convenient to choose the mode functions in such a way that their associated vector 0 happens to be the vector which, for physical reasons, is the Hilbert space vector that describes the vacuum. Now, it could be that later on, there may be stuff happening in the meantime, and later on, the universe may again be in a vacuum state. Or maybe it's in a third excited state, but that's obtained from the vacuum state by applying creation operators. So in any case, we may be interested in what is the vacuum state at a later time. Then we can go through the same exercise here. We try to find mode functions such that the associated vector 0 tilde now happens to be what the vacuum state is at a later time. Now you may wonder, wait a moment, isn't it sufficient to identify which is the vacuum state at an early time, and then that will tell us what the vacuum state is at any time? No, that's not so. Because remember, we are going to work in the Schrödinger picture, in the Heisenberg picture here, which means that the state in which the system is in is always the same. By definition, by construction, the operators evolve in time. Therefore, if the system is in the vacuum state at an early stage, then this vacuum state is described by some Hilbert space vector. And at a later time, the vacuum state can no longer, in general, be described by that same Hilbert space vector, because the system will evolve out of the vacuum, will become an excited state with particles in it, and so on. So in the Heisenberg picture, we have that the meaning of states is changing. The state is frozen in time itself, but its meaning is evolving. That's because operators give meaning to what a vector means in Hilbert space, and the operators are now evolving in time in the Heisenberg picture. Okay? So if we ask which vector is the vacuum state, we have to ask when. At an early time, the vacuum is described by one vector in the Hilbert space. At a later time, the vacuum is described by another vector in Hilbert space. At a yet later time, the vacuum is described by yet another vector in the Hilbert space. Just like we had it in the case of the driven harmonic oscillator very early in the course. We worked with the Heisenberg picture, and the ground state was a different vector in the Hilbert space early than it was late. So how many possible choices of mode functions are there? Well, we can choose a bunch of mode functions V. We can choose a bunch of mode functions V tilde, a bunch of mode functions V double tilde. The only requirement is that each of those bunches obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. Each element of it obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And each element of it also obeys the Wronskian condition. And by each element, I mean as we run through all possible wave vectors K. We already said that in principle there are infinitely many choices. We know that on general grounds already. But let's look at it more closely here in the case of FRW cosmology. In this case, things become much simpler because the space dependence has been Fourier transformed out. So now we're just looking at individual modes. Let us consider each mode K separately. What does, for a fixed K, for a fixed mode, for a fixed wave vector, therefore, what are the conditions again on these mode functions? Well, obey the Klein-Gordon equation and obey the Wronskian condition. How many solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation are there? So K is fixed, therefore that is fixed. This has a time dependence here, and we have a second order differential equation, second order in time. So we expect that the solution space is two-dimensional. Two complex dimensions. After all, we have to use complex valued solutions here in order to get ahead. All right, so the solution space is four-dimensional for each K. In other words, it looks like there is a four-parameter family of possible vacua for each mode, as far as each mode is concerned. It's not really true. It is true that there is a two-dimensional vector space of solutions, of two complex dimensional vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation for every fixed K, which is really a four-dimensional real vector space. But in addition to that, our mode functions also have to obey this Wronskian condition. And the Wronskian condition, just a sec, I'm anticipating here a little bit. Okay, here it is. The Wronskian condition is one extra condition, and that reduces the dimensionality of the solution space to 3. So if we hold K fixed, then there's a two complex dimensional space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, 4 real dimensions, but the solutions also have to obey that condition, that non-linear in V condition, which is really that the imaginary part of this product has to be equal to to 1. That's what we have here. And that is one real condition. So therefore, the four-dimensional vector space gets reduced to a three-dimensional manifold, a three-parameter space of solutions. So for every mode function k, we have to think afresh. What's the vacuum? Or what are the possible choices of mode function? Each choice of mode function comes with associated A and A dagger operators and with an associated vector 0, a ket with a 0 in it. And we may want to choose that ket with a 0 in it to coincide with the actual physical vacuum of the theory at a particular point in time. Not necessarily, but it's a convenient choice, as we will see. What I also wanted to say is that, very importantly, the solution space to the Klein-Gordon equation, here it is again, has two complex dimensions, and that has a very important implication. Namely, as we change from one choice of mode function v to another choice of mode function v tilde, we know that they are not completely unrelated, because they live in the same vector space, which has only two dimensions. In fact, it's great that it's only two dimensions, because in this way, when v is a complex valued solution, then it spans one dimension of the solution space, and its complex conjugate will span the other dimension. Right? So if v is a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then v star is going to span, together with v, the entire two-dimensional space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So we have two basis functions, and indeed, any solution to the Klein-Gordon equation can be expressed as a complex linear combination of those two guys. Which means, in particular, that if we change our mind, we worked initially with the v mode function, and then we say, okay, if you want to work with the v tilde mode function later on, then one set might be useful at early times, the other one at later times, for example, then we can write down right away that the solution v tilde must be some linear combination of the solution v, where these are just complex numbers. And remember, there's a label k, because for every mode we can do that. For every wave vector k, for every mode k, we can do that. We can express any choice of mode function as a linear combination of some choice of mode function. And vice versa, of course, we could express the v in terms of v tilde and its complex conjugate. This is going to be part of those famous Bogoliubov transformations. Now imagine that we have a mode function vk which obeys the Wronskian condition. And of course, it's a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And then imagine that we define a v tilde that is also a solution in the of the Klein-Gordon equation. So it's in the same two-dimensional solution space. So v tilde is, as we just discussed, a linear combination of v and its complex conjugate. Then is it guaranteed that if v is a legal mode function, v tilde is as well? It's not guaranteed, right? Because in order to be a legal mode function, one that we can use to generate a proper solution of the quantum field theory, is a mode function that not only obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, but also the Wronskian condition. So if v and v star are solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, for sure, any linear combination of them is solving the Klein-Gordon equation. But just because v obeys the Wronskian condition doesn't guarantee that v tilde does. I leave it to you as an exercise to prove that this is the condition on the alpha k and the beta k coefficients, such that the v tilde also obey the Wronskian condition. Okay? All you have to do is plug that into the Wronskian condition. Let me just write it up again. Let me just show you again where it is. Here it is. Is the Wronskian condition, right? Write it for v tilde, just put tildes over everything, and then express v tilde in terms of the v. We know that the v obeyed the Wronskian condition, so then you have to find out what condition on the alpha and beta will guarantee that the truth of the Wronskian condition for v will imply the holding of the Wronskian condition for v tilde. That's the condition. Again, a crucial part of the Bogoliubov transformation. So what we then obtain is, if both are legal solutions to the problem, v and v tilde, then we can write our quantum field either in terms of v and v tilde with their associated a and a dagger, or alternatively and completely equivalently, we can write our quantum field in terms of the v tildes and its complex conjugate, and the A tilde and the A tilde dagger operators. Completely the same thing. And now we know also something about how they are related to each other, namely through those coefficients alpha k and beta k. Let's call this equation we will call B and that one P. They will come up in a moment. So as I mentioned already, these transformations from one set of mode functions with A operators and the Fock basis that comes with them to some other set of mode functions and the Fock basis that comes with them, that type of transformation is called the Bogoliubov transformation. So our next task will be to do, well, there will be two tasks. The first is we need to find out more about those Bogoliubov transformations. Just as we did at the beginning of the course for the driven harmonic oscillator, where we calculated exactly how we got from the Fock basis before the driving force acted through a unitary transformation to the Fock basis of the time after the driving of the harmonic oscillator ended. Similarly here, we should be able to find the unitary transformation that gets us from one choice of basis to the other choice of basis for those two different choices of mode functions. Obviously, this is going to be crucial if we want to calculate the creation of particles out of expansion. If the universe starts out in the vacuum state, and then the universe has some non-trivial evolution, it will generally excite the field. And that excitation can be calculated by changing that change of basis. Because we compare the state which used to be the vacuum with the state that now is the vacuum. And we find that the evolution has been trivial. The state that used to be the vacuum state is now a state full of particles. That's how we can calculate the generating of particles through expansion. Okay, so first there's a mathematical task. Make the Bogoliubov-Hilbert basis transformations explicit. And then once we are good at that, we can make our choices. We can then say, okay, which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum vector? On physical grounds, the mathematics cannot tell us. We'll have to find out on physical grounds which vector in the Hilbert space is the vacuum vector. One guess might be that it's the state of minimum energy. Turns out that's the wrong guess. So we will find out what state in the Hilbert space is at a particular time the vacuum state. And then it might be convenient to use the tricks that we've learned to choose our mode function such that the state zero coincides with that state. See, this is a matter of matching the physics with the math. So first, we need to study more the mathematics of these Bogoliubov transformations of Hilbert bases. So the question is this. Imagine we make one choice of mode function, and we get the vector 0 tilde, and its associated other vectors of the Fock bases out of that. So the V tilde mode functions give us this basis in the Hilbert space. And then we may also have another choice of mode functions, V, and they come with this choice of Hilbert basis. The question is, how do we express these basis vectors as linear combinations of those? Must be possible. They are, after all, just basis vectors in the same Hilbert space. In particular, this vector is going to be a linear combination of that and all those guys. And that one is a linear combination of this and all those other guys. What are these linear combinations? Crucial for finding this out will be this relationship here, namely that the annihilation operators without the tilde are a linear combination of the annihilation and creation operators with the tildes. And the coefficients, the linear combination coefficients, are going to be alpha star and beta. Remember early on in this course when we considered the driven harmonic oscillator, we had a similar key equation. We found that the A operator, after the force has acted, is given by the A operator earlier, before the force started to act, plus J naught, where J naught was just a number times the identity operator, right? And J naught was some integral over the driving force. Now it's not quite that easy. Now we find that the A operator, as we change from one Hilbert basis, from one Fock basis to the other, is generally a linear combination of the A's and of the A tildes and the A tilde daggers. Now, where do we get this from? Why would that be true? Why is A such a just a linear combination of the A tildes and the A dagger tildes? Well, that follows straightforwardly from the equations B and P that we had above. Let me show you. B and P. Right, so here's the equation B. It says that the mode functions V tilde are always some linear combination of the mode functions V. Just because they live in the same two-dimensional solution space, one has to be expressible in terms of the other, right? So if V is a complex solution, V star is a complex solution, and they're linearly independent, if they're really complex valued, and so they span that Hilbert space, the two-dimensional solution space of the Klein-Gordon equation, and so on. Okay. And then we said that if the alphas and the betas obey that condition, then V tilde is really also a legal mode function, because not only does it obey the Klein-Gordon equation, but also the Wronskian condition. So let's see, assume we have both. We have this relationship between the V and the V tilde, and we can express the same field this way or that way. Okay, so all we have to do now is substitute the V tildes here. So where the V tildes are, here are the V tildes. Don't write the V tildes, write the right-hand side. Okay? So the V tildes are expressed as alpha V plus beta V star. And here too, that's expressed as alpha V plus beta V star. And then just look at this line being equal to that line. And you see that some stuff in terms of the V times A and A dagger is some stuff in terms of alpha, beta, and the V's, plus some stuff with alpha, betas, and the V's with the A tilde, and here the A tilde and A tilde dagger. And in this, since this has to be true for all time, you can read off which coefficients have to match. And what you find is what we claimed over here in the equation in the box. Namely, this can only work out if the A is that coefficient times A tilde plus this coefficient times A tilde dagger. That helps us now to develop the relationship between the two different Hilbert bases. See, we know that the annihilation operator A annihilates the vector 0, because that's by construction. But using this equation in the box, we can express A as the right-hand side. So this equation is really also that equation. So what we learn here is that the operator A does not annihilate the vector 0. The vector A tilde doesn't annihilate the vector A, doesn't annihilate the vector 0. The operator A tilde annihilates the 0 tilde, right? But the operator A tilde, with some little help from its brother A tilde dagger, will annihilate that. Okay, so we have now a non-trivial equation between the tilded operators and the untilded vector over here. And that gives us a chance to build that bridge between the two Hilbert bases. So let's try to express the untilded vector zero in terms of the only tilded quantities. So let's try to express the vector zero as some sort of complicated expression that involves tilded dagger operators acting on the tilded zero. There is not much wisdom in this because it's guaranteed to work. You see, we know that this vector and that vector live in the same Hilbert space. So there's got to be some sort of, it's got to be some way to express the one as a combination of the other, as a linear combination of the basis vectors of the other. And by applying those a tilde operators onto this vector zero tilde, we can generate all excitations. We can generate all Fock vectors of the other bases. Therefore, it's got to work. And the product K simply says that when we do that separately for each K. Now, we could go through several pages of deriving what the proper linear combination is, but it is actually easier to use the solution method of the known solution. So, you know, the way that mathematicians proceed. So this is the solution to the problem, and then try to show that it actually is a solution. So here is the proposition, and of course I leave it to you to prove this, but it, believe me, it's not hard, because don't be scared about the product over all k. It's completely separate, so you can do it for every k separately. And then you just have that thing, and I give you a hint of how it's actually proven. But let's look at this equation and what it really says. What this says is that the vector zero of one Hilbert basis generated from one set of mode functions is a linear combination of the Fock bases with the tildes in the following way. Forget about the product over k for now. Let's just look at one k value, let's say. This thing is just a normalizing prefactor to make sure that the vector that we obtain here really has length 1, because this is normalized to length 1. This better also has length 1. So that's a matter of, you know, just straightforward calculation to find out that this is the proper normalization factor. This is where it's getting interesting. What we have here is the exponential of this business acting on that. What this tells us right away, if you look at it closely, is that when, during the evolution of the universe, curvature creates particles, it creates them in pairs. It creates them in pairs where, you know, one goes off with momentum k in this direction and the other one goes off in direction minus k the other way. We can see that here, because this exponential should really be viewed as the series that the exponential is really defined as, right? So this is the sum n going to from 0 to infinity, 1 over n factorial, this stuff to the power of n, sum over all n, right? So in particular, the lowest order term of this thing in that series is just the identity. What this is saying is that the vector 0 without a tilde has some component of the vector 0 with the tilde. But there's more. It's a linear combination of that, you know, 1 times this, plus. Next order term is just this thing here acting on that. What is this? When this term here, the second term in the exponential, when this term here acts on that, we get an a dagger with a minus k acting here and an a dagger with a plus k acting here. The a dagger with the minus k produces or ends up meaning a vector that describes a quantum field where there is one particle with momentum minus k. It's one particle because there's one a dagger, and the momentum is minus k. This thing also acts on that vector, so now the state is a state with two particles, one going momentum minus k, the other one momentum k. And that's just some prefactor here. Then what's the next term in the expansion of that exponential? Well, it's this thing squared divided by 2. So it's this thing squared. So now we have two particles going off in momentum k and two particles going off in momentum minus k. And it goes on like this. So what we see is that the vector 0 of one Hilbert basis is a linear combination of the vector 0 of the other Hilbert basis plus vectors in the other Hilbert basis, which would describe particles going in opposite directions produced pairwise. Of course, I've slightly overstated things here because we haven't really committed to this being the vacuum state, right? If this is the vacuum state at a particular time, for example, then yes, this is the interpretation that we can apply. But oftentimes, that's what we will do, of course. We will choose the vector 0 tilde to be the vacuum state, at least at a particular time. And then this particular state here is a state full of particles. And if the system is actually in this state, it means that the system is not in the vacuum state. It is in a state where there are lots of particles present. So now, if you want to prove this, how do you go about that? Well, to prove this, right? Remember where this came from? We had shown that the A operator is a linear combination for each mode of the A tilde and the A tilde daggers. Now, that means that we can write the equation that A annihilates its zero vector in this way, simply by replacing A by its right-hand side over here. So that equation must be true. So here we have the tilde operators acting on an untilde zero that's equal to zero. You can view this as a defining equation for this thing. Because remember, this is the defining equation for zero, for the vector zero. So now, in order to show that this right-hand side really is the vector 0, we can either apply A on it, on the left-hand side, and show that it annihilates it. But that's not convenient, because we would have to apply A here on the right-hand side, and A is not easily related to A tildes, A dagger tildes, to 0 tildes. What we can do instead is, instead of writing A applied to that, we write this applied to it, right? So it's those tilde operators. So in order to show that this really is what that is, we apply A here, which is to say we apply that thing over here, we apply it over there, and it's just A tildes and A tilde daggers that we have to apply to show that this is equal to 0. How do we do that? Well, we have to take the A tilde operator, multiply with alpha, and multiply it from the left, and then add to it B times A tilde dagger and multiply it from the left. And then see whether or not the whole thing is 0. Now, whenever you have A operators, in this case A tilde operators, acting on something that involves lots of A daggers and eventually a 0 tilde, then it is a good strategy to use the commutation relations between the A tildes and their daggers to move the A tilde all the way from the left to the right, where it then can annihilate that vector 0 tilde. So when we apply this thing here to the left on that, let us pay particular attention on the A tilde. So the A tilde arrives over here, and then we want to commute it through this so that eventually, after it has been commuted through that, acts on that where the whole thing goes away. Now, as you commute an A tilde operator through this thing which contains lots of A dagger tilde operators, you get some debris. You can't just commute it through. There will be some fallout. There will be some terms left over. And those terms will be exactly what you get when you take that thing and multiply it on the left-hand side with an overall minus sign. That's why it will all go away. See, the 8 tilde term is easy because the 8 tilde dagger term is easy because the 8 tilde daggers all commute with each other. You can write that wherever you want. But the A operator commuted through this is a non-trivial procedure. Commuting it through this is a non-trivial procedure. And in practice, you do it this way. You write your exponential as a series again. 1 minus this plus 1 half this thing squared, etc. It's a series. And so overall, you just have to commute this thing through polynomials. So powers of this, really. Now, what you can show when you do this, let's put it this way. A very useful tool for this purpose is the following relationship that I recommend you prove as an exercise. If you have an A operator and an A dagger operator, and you want to calculate what happens when I commute the A through that exponential with the A dagger here. See, I'm writing here the commutator. It's A on the left of the exponential equal to A on the right of the exponential. So if I put this on the other side, I have the commutator between A and the exponential. It turns out it's this. The commutator of A with any function of A dagger is basically the derivative of that function of A dagger. See that? It's as if I had differentiated with respect to A dagger. So as I commute A through this power series, I get that power series again, plus extra terms. And those extra terms arise because whenever I commute through some A dagger to the power of n, what do I get? I get n times a to the power n minus 1. Right? Each time I have a commutator of A with a dagger, I get a 1. If I have a commutator with A and a dagger to the power n, I get something which is a dagger to the power of n minus 1. I'm always getting rid of one a dagger as I commute with the a through it. So in order to prove this, just prove it for every individual term in that exponential. That's quite straightforward. And once you have that equation, just apply it over here. We have to apply the A operator here, the A tilde operator here. We want to commute it through this, which means that we have to differentiate this thing with respect to the A tilde daggers. It looks as if there is a square up here, but it's not the same number. It's not the same object that is being squared. There is A dagger K and A dagger minus K. When we have an A tilde arriving over here, then depending on whether it has a K or minus K, it will either commute, it will either not commute with one of them or the other, but it won't not commute with both. Okay, so the last point is just interpretation of this transformation here. So this is the transformation that gets us from one Hilbert basis to the other. Technically, this is only telling us what the zero vector of one Hilbert basis looks like in terms of the other Hilbert basis. But of course, that solves the whole problem. Because if we, let's say, want to know what a fifth excited state looks like, then we can do that. We write here the five powers of A dagger. That gives us the fifth excited state of the untilded Hilbert basis. And what is that in terms of the tilde Hilbert basis? Well, we have to apply the fifth power of A dagger. But we will be clever, of course, and express A dagger in terms of the tilded operators this way. Just take the dagger of this, and we get the tilded operators. So overall, we have here on the left-hand side then the fifth excited state of the untilded basis. And on the right-hand side, we have this business. And we have the fifth power of the A dagger expressed in terms of the tilded operator. And therefore, we can express even the fifth excited state in terms of the Hilbert basis of the tilded variables. So it's really the complete change of basis that we have here. As I indicated earlier, it will often be convenient to choose the Hilbert basis according to what the physics demands. At different times, it might be, like early in the evolution or late in the evolution, it might be convenient to use one Hilbert basis or the other Hilbert basis. Right, and the main point I wanted to make at the end was, and I already said that, what we can read off from this is that if this is, let's say, chosen to be the vacuum state at an early time, then it will always be the state of the system, because we're working in the Heisenberg picture. Now, if this happens to be the vacuum state at a later time, well, the system is still stuck in that because of the Heisenberg picture. So if this happens to be the vacuum state at a later time, and the system is in this state, then it means that at a later time, the system is not really in the vacuum anymore, because the system is, as always, this state, which is an excited state at a later time, if this is the vacuum at a later time. So this will be very useful for calculating the production of particles, and what we've seen so far is that they come in pairs. This is, of course, assuming that we can even interpret these things in terms of particles. As we will later see in cosmology, there are situations when the particle interpretation as such breaks down. And we don't have, properly speaking, a vacuum state or excited state with particles. Then we have only available the field picture. But these equations will still hold. That's it for today.